All right, welcome to the Sports Ethos Los Angeles Chargers podcast here with Will, Shane, and Brandon, the whole crew. How are you doing on this Sunday afternoon, my friends?
Doing fantastic. It's raining where I'm at, but it's all pretty good.
It's raining in Michigan. It's raining in Michigan, bro. Yeah. It's raining today.
Yeah, I got an Amber Alert basically saying it's a thunderstorm watching.
Oh, Jesus. Well, at least this takes your mind off it.
Yep.
Chicago's got hail right now.
Jeez.
Man. It's sunny here in rainy Seattle.
Yep.
That's interesting. What a wild turn. You know, funny, it rained a little bit yesterday here too. It dipped. Yesterday here was almost 80. Today it's like 45.
Wait, it rains in New Jersey?
Yeah.
A good bit.
Wait for this whole next month. You're gonna hear me say basically every show is gonna start the same. It's raining in New Jersey because every day in April in New Jersey it rains.
So basically, it's gonna become Gotham as we're doing the Batman.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we're getting some rain here in the next couple of weeks, but that's to be expected. Light drizzle. All right, so we're gonna do something fun throughout the off season. We're gonna continue our rewatches. We did a couple games last year, but Will and Shane, we're finally doing a Seahawks game, and this is probably the number one game to do, the 2013 NFC title game.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, let's go.
So I think. Go ahead, Shane. Sorry.
Go ahead.
All right. No, to start this off, I think the way I want to start this off is the quarterbacks, because this is such an interesting quarterback game. Because I'm a firm believer that if John Harbaugh, you know, didn't get fired a couple years later. From this game, what was that, late 2014, 2015, I believe Colin Kaepernick would have had a Hall of Fame career. I've always been a firm believer in that. You don't think so, Shane?
Hell no.
Really? No, let's start with this, because I think this is such an important thing, because Colin Kaepernick had a bunch of really good runs in this game. I think he's the most intriguing player in this game, actually, but let's start with that, Shane.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think the fact that your biggest takeaway from this game was the quarterbacks is kind of strange, because these two are like the last thing I think of when I think of this game. I think of the defenses.
Defenses are amazing in this game. They're incredible.
This was prime Legion of Boom, and many people forget, but this Niners defense was also really good. They just kind of got overshadowed a bit.
It was the DC.
Man, I heard Vangio thing. I thought Brandon was like, oh my God. Oh. Man, Brandon had an aneurysm.
He called a good game in this game, though. He did call a good game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But anyways.
Doesn't matter. You guys won.
when I look at his career, I mean, he had a career completion percentage of, I think, 59. I don't even think it was 60, which is terrible. I think in his, let me just look. So in his
Pro
best season, he threw 21 touchdowns, which is, I mean, if that's your best season, that's laughable. But aside from the stats, I mean, I think a lot of times we look at guy, you know, especially recently with people like Allen, we look at these guys who are 6'4", 230, all muscular, everything. And we're like, they had so much potential but I mean, the truth is, this guy had one okay season. I wouldn't even call it great. I would just call it okay. I would argue kind of carried by the run game and the defense. And then every year after that just got worse and worse and worse. So,
you know, and yeah, that, I mean,
this,
And that brings me to a bigger point too, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and like, this is a guy that, I mean, yeah, he had some good running, but at the end of the day, he didn't throw the ball very well. He didn't make good decisions in the pocket. You know, I think at best, he would have had like a Cam Newton career.
And that's, you know? and that's a perfect segue, because that's the kind of what I was interested in. And you guys can help me list these quarterbacks, right? Let's think about this era, right? Because I think this era of quarterback was super fast. It came and went so quickly, and I think there's a major reason for it. We said Cam Newton. We said Colin Kaepernick. Russell Wilson. Who else can you guys think of? Like,
you know, well,
running
quarterback. You know who it all started with? Michael Vick.
We started before that. I was gonna say Randall Cunningham was the first.
But like, well, what I mean is Vick was like the first, like, big one where we were all like, whoa, this is cool, you know. And then it kind of from there, whether it's him or Cunningham, whoever, you know, there was definitely a moment around there where it was like, oh, this is going to be the future of quarterback play. And so then we all bought into these guys that were just, you know, big physical running quarterbacks. But we forgot about what it is that is important in this position, and that's throwing and having it between the ears. You know, so we got a lot of guys like Kaepernick and Cam. There's probably other Joe Flacco, somewhat. I mean,
Robert Griffin III. Robert Griffin III. There you go.
RG3 used to be more. Yeah, RG3. Although his career was, his career was more so an injury thing. But I mean, Tim Tebow.
Oh my god.
He was one. I mean, hey, I'm just saying. Let's see. Who else was there?
Luck scrambled a little bit.
Vince Young was the same thing.
Luck, yeah. But Luck, I think.
Vince Young, like, yeah. Pretty smart.
Jay Cutler. That's another one.
Jay Cutler.
Yeah. But let's think of, like, those guys weren't primarily runners. Like, RG3, primarily a runner. Cam Newton, primarily a runner.
Although, like, to be fair, RG3's career was more derailed by injuries as opposed to a
100%. But 100%. But my point with this overall is this era of quarterbacks. So I'm thinking, like, let's say
Mariota.
Like 2020, let's say late 2011 to like 2013. And then it died immediately, so quickly.
I would say like 15.
15. Okay.
Here's the
poster child of this, in my opinion, because from that era, I think he's had the longest, most sustained career, for better or for worse, the new quarterback for the New York Giants and Russell Wilson, right? Who we see in this game not being extremely productive. And Will, you can attest to this, I think, as well. Like, both of these NFC title games for the Seahawks, both 2013 and 2014, that first half, and really the entire game for both of those NFC title games, were mostly defense. The offense wasn't that impressive at all.
Yeah, it's usually a thing with the Seahawks that, you know, the defense carries while the offense tried to do their thing. And like with this game, it was, you know, there's some questionable calls here and there. Some plays there. There was that one touchdown by Marshawn Lynch, and then after that, it was just basically like, we, you know, try to push the ball, but then be short at the fourth down mark, or try to just settle for a field or something like that. So, it's mostly just been, you know, rely on more the defense and the running game, like what the Niners were doing. The Packers before in the 2014 NFC Championship game, well, they rely on Aaron Rodgers, but, you know, their defense sort of gave up some points of a comeback while they didn't push the ball and didn't end the game right away. So that would happen there. Same thing with the Niners. That Niners, yeah, sure, they were controlling the game somewhat. The defense did pretty good, but they kept keeping the game close. And that's how the Seahawks basically won that game. Same with the 2014. So it's something that's usually been identity for the Seahawks with Pete Carroll. And basically, that's what he's, I guess, I guess we'll see what he does with the Las Vegas Raiders. They're going. He's going to do the same thing. Basically, go for the running game and just rely on the defense, and then the passing game comes as the running back game goes. So it's something that's an identity with Pete Carroll and that Seahawks offense, and it's showing it both NFC Championship games. It's a philosophy that has its, like, you know, advantages, but sometimes as longevity goes, it's going to be some positives and some negatives, especially if you're trying to have a more efficient offense.
Yeah. And the negative, Brandon, I think across the league throughout those next few years, if you look at the draft pool, they, you know, a bunch of teams went after corners when you would argue offensive line, defensive line, quarterback, as Shane always talks about, the most important positions. You know, every combine, you know, after those 2 years for at least a little while, was just the focus was so much on the quarterback or on the cornerback position and, you know, the secondary, because teams wanted to build the Legion of Boom. And that kind of killed a lot of teams, you know, over the course of the late 2010s, was kind of building through the secondary. It was the wrong approach. Yeah. And Seattle was the only team to perfect it because they had players that could do it.
Yeah, you know, because when we talk about the NFL nowadays, right, you know, we talk about, you know, where do you need to build first? You need to build in the trenches. And, you know, because when you have to build outward, not kind of build back inward. You can't go outside and go to, hey, we want corners, wide receivers, whatever, if you don't have the meat and potatoes inside to branch out from. So, you know, I feel like, you know, a lot in that, especially in that era, yeah, just so many teams kind of swung big on, you know, big name draft picks, or hell, even there was times where they might not got a big name draft pick in the first round. They picked late, but then they would end up, you know, just stacking up their, like, you know, out of their, what, seven rounds, it would be like, you know, they would have like six picks in total, you know, maybe trade one of them away or something like that. And then, but like out of those six picks, like half of them at least would, or really probably even four of them would be like, you know, a lot of defense heavy, but especially secondary. So, but the thing is, you know, you can't, and then this is what we've seen also with some teams even nowadays going very defense heavy, because that's been their identity for not just the last 10 years, but for the last, you know, 50. Like a team like the Steelers constantly kind of going, you know, defense heavy and bringing in a lot of different guys that kind of fit what they want to do, you know, playing a stout kind of defense. Here's the problem, though. You can't, and I think that it's what a lot of teams figured out back then in this era, too, is that you can't go too heavily on one side of the ball or the other. I mean, you have to figure out what you need more of, yes, but at the same time, you can't just have a defense and not have an offense, because the defense is going to be tired. And in this game, especially, you could see, I mean, early on, both defenses were on the money. But especially that last quarter and a half, those defenses were tired. I mean, they're chasing, you know, both quarterbacks could run. Both quarterbacks, I mean, they weren't great. I mean, Russell Wilson at that time was a better thrower than he is now. But in this game, he struggled to throw the ball, at least a little bit. And, of course, Kaepernick couldn't throw at all. So, but when you're constantly having to chase, and having to hang, and because of that, having to hang on to wide receivers for extended periods of time and tiring out your defense, you're going to get tired. You know, big plays are going to happen, and the bigger plays started happening on both sides of this game towards the end, you know, and obviously more chaos ensued from there, you know, a couple fumbles, things like that. But yeah, you can't, you know, this game, you know, the NFL kind of constantly kind of has, like, every so often, there's that copycat syndrome, right? I mean, it happens in a bunch of different sports, but in football, it kind of happens a lot. You know, one team perfects a certain way of doing things and has a lot of success with it, like, you know, like the Chiefs recently, or Philly, or with the Patriots in the last, you know, 20 years. You know, they have a certain way of doing things, and then teams want to emulate that. But the problem is, you can't do it like the original. That's the thing, and, you know. Hell, I mean, just to be a homer for 1 second before we get back to this, Billy found out pretty quickly in the last 10 years, you can't run your style of zone defense and kind of do it the way you want to do it, because you're too busy getting copycats of Vic Fangio when you should be getting Vic Fangio himself. And they got brought him in, and look, boom, it works. Because you're getting the mastermind, you're getting the architect of it versus a copycat. So same thing with this. You know, you see the Legion of Boom. No, go ahead, Shane.
I was going to say, speaking of Philly and copycats, for a long time, it feels like that's what they've been doing with Andy Reid.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. Yeah. But no, it's definitely true. But it's like, you know, you can't model success off of what another team does. You have to find your own way to do it. And, you know, but the thing is, everybody should have the same kind of, I think, what makes a league great, what makes a league, you know, for across all 32 teams for any sport, is every team should kind of go into their draft process or free agency process with the same thing. Start, have the same kind of idea of where you need to start or want to start, and then branch out. Don't be concerned with what other teams did to win a Super Bowl. Because when you start looking at, well, you know, what Seattle did, it's like, yeah, you're not going to be Seattle. You're not going to have 3, 4, 5 guys that are going to play physically as all hell in the secondary, hit like a freight train, and, oh, yeah, provide the tightest coverage, you know. Like, if the coverage was any tighter, you'd be shipping yourself in a cardboard box somewhere.
You know what it made me think of? It made me think of the Commanders this year. How handsy they were, how they went to, like, they went to such a worse level of that, and then just like, they just got burned by flags and stuff because the air has changed. And Will, yeah. I think that's also an interesting part for me in this game, is like, the hit sticks were crazy. The physicality, it was such a different game back even 10 years ago. I mean, it evolves, but it definitely changed it. Offensive friendly flags, penalties being more of a thing that affects the secondary. This Seahawks team, I think, you know, retroactively was the start of you know, the league changing the rules to benefit the offense in some degree.
Yeah, it's it went a long way, because I think before, you know, actually currently, you know, the Sean McVay's, the Kyle Shanahan's, they usually change the way as far as offense goes, and that's how people are going now with the offense, of how they usually approach that game. And then it's mostly more of an offensive game, because the defense now, when we look at it, especially in this game, like, you know, we saw physicality, like, you know, Cam Chancellor, you know, when he, like, delivered the hit, and we know how physical he is, and how Earl is physical from ball to ball, almost every single play. And then also you got the defensive line with McDaniels basically going up the middle, then also Cliff Avril with that strip sack. Like, I kind of miss those type of days, because that was the same days with the Ravens, the Baltimore Ravens defense, the Chicago Bears defense in the 2000s, like that type of defense. And now we're just mostly going to more offensive game. And to be honest, I feel like that direction really hit, it really shows, and I feel like it really moved forward. I don't know if you guys remember, but that Chiefs and Rams game where I think both sides got like 50-something points, and I feel like that's the way to go, basically just keep scoring. And I felt, and after that, it's like, oh, the Roger Goodell's like, man, that's a high scoring game. It got a lot of viewers, I believe, in that primetime match. It was like, okay, let's try to save these players and stuff and get more of the offensive side and get some more point production and handicap the defense and try to do what they have to do. Though, you know, in the Super Bowl, obviously with no line, obviously it didn't really show, especially how the Eagles play, because the defense is still there. We still get some good defensive performance. It showed in the Super Bowl, but that's usually a rarity just because of how the game changed. But yeah, it really shows in this game that we just seen between the Niners and Seahawks, but both sides, as far as defense goes, is that it shows that basically defense can make an intriguing matchup, an intriguing game, especially how well you draft and how well your philosophy is and how well the fans really pick it up and enjoy it. Because it's not really everyone's cup of tea, but it has its fans.
Oh, yeah. No, I think this game was all of our cup of teas in a bunch of different ways. But Shane, we talk a lot about, you know, in recent years, especially latter years for Pete Carroll, you know, sticking with this, you know, base cover three defense that he ran with this group so successfully, or even some man-to-man in certain cases. But, you know, in his last few years with Seattle, it faded away because just the talent wasn't as good. Like, you made a huge emphasis in the broadcast to talk about the fact that they were running super basic coverages, and it was fairly successful, honestly, even more than fairly successful, obviously winning that Super Bowl that year. But, you know, that was something that I thought about, and I'm sure you did too, of like just the simplicity of the coverage and that being so effective. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Shane, go ahead on that. You can go from there.
I'm muted. Whoops. but yeah, you know, part of, I think, you know, when it comes to like the Legion of Boom specifically, yeah, I mean, yeah, it was simple coverages, but at the same time, that secondary was very cerebral. They all knew exactly where they needed to be. There was no miscommunication. That's what the newer or the more recent, you know, Pete Carroll teams lacked. But not that they weren't, you know, not that those, like, the Legion of Boom wasn't super physical and all, you know, but it's just, that was the biggest thing, was just their cognitive ability was really high. And, you know, I think something, at least to me, that, you know, people forget about with that team is, I mean, yeah, we all think about the secondary because, you know, they played lights out and they were great, but really what was the anchor and made that defense so good was the front four. I mean, we all forget about it, but they were a team that could always put pressure on the quarterback just rushing four. You know, I mean, between Michael Bennett, Chris Clemens,
Red Bryant, Cliff Averill.
Yeah, I mean, this was a stacked front four. And, you know, they would get to the quarterback so fast, and that was what ended up leading to, you know, quarterbacks like Kaepernick, who weren't the sharpest guys to, you know, force the ball into bad situations where Sherm or where Thomas was waiting to pick, you know. So I think we can't forget about that piece of it. Not to mention, you know, you also have prime Bobby Wagner right in the middle, just kind of to patrol things.
That's what he did in this game too. He just patrolled the middle. That's all he did. And it
He's a middle linebacker. It's in the name.
It's in the name, exactly. That's the thing. Like, he was just commanding that entire defense. It wasn't necessarily statistical.
And now he's a commander.
I see what you did there. He, Bobby Wagner's commanding. That's I get it.
And then I was also Dan Quinn there. So, you know, there's like two commanders.
Commander seeds for the commanders. And, you know, speaking of that, switching to the Niners side, Brandon, Vic Fangio, you can see the seeds from your Super Bowl winning team this year in this roster.
Yeah. I mean, heavy pressure, you know, funny, heavy pressure without blitzing, which is kind of the same thing, you know, obviously this year. Heavy pressure without blitzing. I mean, being pretty, I mean, also it was a different era. They could be a little more physical than they could on defense, but still very physical defensively, very handsy, but without kind of taking unnecessary penalties. But you know, one of the biggest things with Fangio versus, you know, he didn't get a ton of say in how he wanted that defense to be in San Fran, but I mean, hey, it got them to, you know, the two NFC championship games back to back and a Super Bowl loss. But you know, Philly let him build this defense the way he wanted to, and he look what he got a Super Bowl ring out of it. So, but yeah, you can kind of see that. I mean, that's why people have said for the longest time, for you know, last like you know, 10 plus years, wherever he's gone with that defense, it's worked. That defense has been good enough to even to carry even some of the worst offenses in football. I mean,
that defense.
Oh yeah, because Miami just a bunch of
Miami. Miami defense hated him for some reason. They pushed him too hard.
Yeah, because they all complain about how hard he coached them. Well, if you're complaining about that hard about being coached that hard, then guess what? Football's not for you.
And this you know, linebacking core too, Navarro Bowman, Patrick Willis. Yeah. I mean, insane.
Oh yeah, in their primes, and it's crazy because those guys, you know, I mean, both of them, well, especially Patrick Willis though, retired pretty early. You know, they still had a few more years left in them, if not more. But both those guys were so dominant. But guess what? Same kind of DNA in Philly. What did Philly have this year? Two exceptional linebackers. One was the best in the NFL. The other one was top five in the NFL. So, you know, the similarities are there between the two versions of the Fangio defense. But, you know, it was no different. You know, I mean, you can say what you want about him as a head coach. He wasn't great, but that, you know, but when he's strictly involved in the defensive side of the ball and that's it, he's one of the best coaches in football. He's a guy that everybody should want.
Yeah.
But I mean, because you know, it's another thing too. It's like you know, they're like, oh, well, he's not blitz heavy, but he doesn't have to be. He finds the players that can make his system work, and that's the whole point. Is that he has a system that a lot of teams. I mean, Seahawks won this game. It wasn't. I mean, yeah, their offense came alive late, but. Because the damn Niners couldn't stop turning the ball over, you know, especially later on in that game, and they couldn't really get anything moving against, you know, at that time, Seahawks had number one defense pretty much in football, or number one pass defense in football. So, you know, you can't ask your defense to do much more than what he asked them to do. So, you know, especially back then, you weren't getting a lot of, you know, blowout type of games. It just wasn't the way football was played. You know, today you get a lot of teams that can score, you know, 35 plus points a game and beat a team, you know, 35-13 or something like that. But back then you were getting a lot of these kind of closer games and we're not even that far removed from it. You know, this game only took place 11 years ago. So, you know, but at the same time, you know, a 23-17 final score. And it came down to really the last, pretty much the last gasp heave from Kaepernick, you know, that got picked off in, you know, in the end zone. So,
which by the way, he didn't need to make that throw. Watching it again, he didn't need to make that throw at all.
Yeah, yeah. What's his name? Wide open on the left side for a touchdown.
Yeah, but that's why, you know, when people keep talking about like, the whole strange history of Colin Kaepernick, it's like, you know, we talk about, you know, how he left the league and things like that. It's like, didn't leave. I mean, there's probably part of that. There's probably truth to how he left the league, you know, being blackballed, whatever. But the majority of it, he just sucked. He wasn't any good.
I just think that Harbaugh would have helped him a lot. Because I think like Jim Tom Sula coming in year was awful. You know what I mean? Oh, like yeah. Them losing, like that's why I think he would have had an incredibly long career. And honestly, I think it probably would have been Hall of Fame worthy. Just because of Harbaugh alone, because I think at that point he knew that Kaepernick was the quarterback he wanted, and then Jed York and him had that whole fallout, and they're just like, all right, Tom Sula, go in, and he doesn't know what to do with him. He didn't know what to do with him at all. It was unbelievable.
Like, it's so weird, because when you look at just how like what the Niners are, the Niners are probably, like, ever since the Rice-Montana era ended, since that era, they've been probably one of the most impatient franchises in football. Because when you think about it, you had Garcia and T.O. together, but not for long. They got impatient. They had some playoff success, but got impatient, split them up when those guys were still, you know, really, really, really good. Split them up. Then you look at the Alex Smith era. Alex Smith had a lot of the same pieces that were on this team, but the Alex Smith era, you know, they got pretty much this far with that, his teams, got impatient, got rid of them, moved on. Kaepernick, to me, out of all the quarterbacks they've had in the last 20 years, to me, he's by far the least talented. So I don't think he would have, like, so to me, it's like, I don't think he would have had a Hall of Fame career. I think he just would have been a quarterback that gets to the playoffs but can't win it. But I don't think, like, the numbers wise probably wouldn't have been great. I mean, you know, I just don't see it. But
I know this is bold. I'm not saying it isn't bold. I just wish we saw 10 more years of it. I feel like we got robbed a little bit.
Well, 10 more years of mid is still mid.
I guess.
But, you know, I don't know. But I could see what you're saying. I get it.
I just, why did they decide to get rid of Harbaugh, man? Like, I still cannot get over that.
Like I'm saying, they're impatient. That team believes that every time they get a system that works and a team that works, they seem to believe they only have 3 years to do it. Like Alex Smith seems like they're like, 3 year window. Kaepernick, what, 2 year window? Garcia, about a 2-3 year window. Purdy, 2-3 year window. Look at Jimmy G. 2-3 year window. Like they seem to only believe they only have a 2-3 year window instead of building something that can last for maybe a decade. So,
or it's, do they not have the right guy to build a decade?
Which could also
when
be
you
a
think
thing
about too. It. Who have they had who's been, you know, a top 10-12 quarterback in the league since Steve Young?
Yeah.
The answer is, in my opinion, nobody. I think Purdy came close, but not quite.
Yeah, but I started thinking about quarterbacks that are top 10. I think Purdy's just outside. I think he's like 11 or 12. I don't think he's 8 or 9.
That's what I mean. That's what I said. I think he came close, but not quite there.
Yeah. Know? Will, what is your opinion on Kaepernick just as a whole? I mean, I know you look at it as a Seahawks fan, same with Shane, and same with me to a certain degree.
There's like a bunch of kids and stuff I remember growing up in middle school and high school. They were a fan of Kaepernick and because of his look, but I think in reality, he was just basically another suited up type of Tim Tebow. Like, he's a great athlete, got the legs, but then when it's time to throw the ball, he's not so great at it. So it was like, I feel like with that, and I feel like, and I agree, I feel like with Kaepernick, it was always like he has something, but I felt like, Joe Harbaugh has something with him, but I agree. They were impatient, and I feel like Jim Harbaugh basically bumped heads with York in the 49ers organization because of the direction for the team. And he felt like, we should go in a different direction. And then with the coach after that, and then them to Kyle Shanahan, where they had some success, but basically now in the same direction they are right now.
It took them years to land Shanahan. They're running with Tom Shula forever.
It took a while.
And Chip Kelly, remember that?
Oh my God, Chip Kelly! I was like, who was after Tom Shula? It was Kelly. Jesus Christ!
That was horrible because it was a lot of mediocrity. I was looking at Chip Kelly was there, and I was thinking like, okay, what's Brandon thinking about after this? He probably laughing his butt off. He's like,
who the hell would see what he did in Philadelphia? Said, oh yeah, that's the guy we want.
I didn't get it. Like, it's weird because they went through a lot of quarterbacks before they even getting Jimmy G. Like the CJ Beathard, they had Nick Mullins. My God, they went through a freaking cycle of mediocrity. It's crazy.
I gotta look this up. I gotta look up all the Niners quarterbacks, like after Kaepernick.
Who the hell is the last quarterback to throw for 30 touchdowns for the Niners? Is it Jeff Garcia?
I have no idea.
Is it like, I know Brock Purdy just did it 2 years ago, but it's Jeff Garcia, and Jeff Garcia did it 20 years ago.
Yeah, and then it's crazy. Then when he went to Cleveland Browns, he crapped the bed.
Yeah, okay. But it's they got impatient with him.
I'm gonna list all the quarterbacks since 2011 who have played snaps for the 49ers. Are you guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay, let's go. Here we go.
Alex Smith.
Since 2011, you said?
2011. Okay. Alex Smith. Ahead. Colin Kaepernick. Okay. So Colin Kaepernick goes till 2014 because he started towards the end of that 2012 season. Then in 2015, he basically split time with Blaine Gabbert.
Oh God.
Blaine Gabbert played. They split 8-8 right down the middle. Kaepernick 11, Gabbert 5 in 16. Then in 17, it was Hoyer, Befford, Garoppolo. Because remember, Garoppolo got traded half of the year.
Yeah, Jimmy G.
Then Mullins, Beathard, Jimmy G, full in 2019. Mullins, Beathard, Garoppolo 15, Lance 2. And then they landed on Purdy in 2022. So there you go.
Jesus.
So much mid.
Yeah, way too much mid.
Jeez. I don't know, man. Honestly, without some sense of Jimmy G and Purdy, and Alex Smith and some of like Colin Kaepernick, man, like this probably is a case of a QB graveyard, somewhat.
A little
more right now. The more I think about it, I'm trying to think. The more I think about it, like, you know, and I think Shane, we were getting towards that, saying that they might not have hit on the right guy. When I think about it, I mean, look at the kind of help that they've given, especially a lot of those early guys, like, you know, giving them a decent offense to work, not even decent, really good at that time, a really good offense to work with, and they did nothing with it, mostly because the quarterback play was just average at best. So it's like that was a team, and the thing is, it's still kind of that way. Like, listen, I know I've beat that dead horse for the last 2 years, but I'm gonna keep beating it. I don't think Brock Purdy's special. I do not see it.
Yeah,
it's
terrible.
But like, yeah, we saw a lot of that last year. And like I've said all the time, you know, once one guy goes down for them, he doesn't do anything. He becomes crap. So, but it seems like that's become the case with a lot of these Niners quarterbacks too. Is like, you know, they don't overcome adversity really well. They don't. They're not good. And then this is what goes back to what Shane says between the ears. They're just not. They're not really sound between the ears. They get rattled very easily. They're not very good decision makers. You know, they're not guys that don't get. You know, that they don't have the ice in their veins to kind of just to take over a game. Like, I don't know how else to describe that, but that seems like that's a trend too. It's just that. You know, like, it really feels like the last time they had a quarterback that could really win a Super Bowl for them was probably with a kind of a lesser offense was probably what, I mean, besides Young, Jeff Garcia wasn't bad. I mean, it wasn't great, but he had two great years there, and then they gave him really nothing after that, and then T.O. left, and that was the end of him. So, you know, that was like, it's just so weird. That for the last, really since the Steve Young era, that's been their MO for 20 years is that, hey, we're going to give our quarterback a 2-3 year shot, 2-3 year window. If you don't win it, we're moving on. It's like, yeah, it's like, is it, you know, it could be a combination of things too. Are they moving on too quick? Possibly. Do they also just see that they don't have the guy? Probably. I think it's a mix of both probably at this point, that they just don't. They're so quick to jump the gun on a guy after he has one good season and then think, oh yeah, this is our franchise guy. We're going to either overpay or we're going to just say, hey, he can go out there and win with what we have, even if it's, you know, but the thing is, you got to also build around the quarterback too. And sometimes, you know, a lot of these guys, Niners have dealt with a lot of injuries over the years. So I think it's just a combination of just kind of they don't seem like they have an identity, put it that way. The Niners don't have the identity or at least they don't have a way of forging an identity where it's like, okay, you know what this team is all about. We know what they're about. We know that they don't make adjustments because of Shanahan. We know all these kinds of things every year. But the players themselves and the way they play football, there is no identity. There's no identity in that franchise. So, and a lot of that's why they've been ringless for longer than the Dallas Cowboys.
That's so nuts. That's crazy to me. Ringless longer than the Cowboys. It's wild.
Yeah, well, it's the trap that they fall into because the thing about the Niners is they do more often than not have a really good roster. It's just that they never get the quarterback right, so they automatically have a bit of a shorter leash on them because they're like, well, you look at this group, we need to win now, and so they don't have as much patience for the guy. You know, but like when that's the case, that's when you do like what the Rams did. You go get, you know, Stafford. You go get whoever.
Odell. Yeah.
Well, no, but I'm talking about like quarterback specifically.
Oh yeah. But still, you go build a stronger roster around them to last those years as well.
Right, and you know, I think San Francisco, they have 5 rings. I think if they'd had competent quarterback play, they'd probably have 2 or 3 more right now.
Hey, we're gonna draft Trey Lance in the draft and think that that's a great move. Okay.
Yeah. And now he's still a free agent. Jesus. Are you guys ready for random things that occurred in this game?
Yes.
Yeah.
Joe Buck in the middle of the second quarter says, "Hey, if you don't like defense, turn this game off." What? Yeah.
That's funny.
What? And the game was super competitive and good by that point. Who remembers NFL on iTunes? You could buy full games on iTunes back in the day. Verizon was leading NFL mobile. So basically this was an era where if you had Verizon, you had access to every local game. And now that's the case with NFL Plus. But if you had Verizon, you had basically everything NFL. Basically, actually very similar to what T-Mobile and MLB do nowadays. Let's see. What else that hit me like a Brinks truck? Oh, Pro Bowl was the draft year. And their promo for it was, "It's fantasy football for real." What? Are you serious? That's your promo. The crowd noise was amazing. Hearing that through like surround sound speakers was so awesome. I don't think we get that in modern NFL games. You can like really hear the crowd like pump through your speakers. That was amazing.
That's also just the 12th man in their prime.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So
just unbelievable. How do you guys grade Joe Buck and Troy Aikman in this game?
We're better on ESPN now. That's all I have to say. They sucked then. They were all that era of Buck and Aikman, I wanted to just cut my ears off. I can't listen to them.
Yeah.
Shit. Will, was it bad for you? Because it was bad for me rewatching it.
It was like a lot of cringe, basically, mostly from the Joe Buck. And I think Troy Aikman was basically Troy Aikman. He always the same way. He just basically say we had to say and say some little quick liners here and there. But I think Joe Buck was the most annoying. But yeah, I got to give it a low, like, at least 4 out of 10.
Yeah, it wasn't good. And actually, the more I can't remember what the quote was. I heard a quote as I was rewatching it. I can't remember. One of them said something stupid, like something insanely stupid. I can't remember what the hell it was. Yeah, but like I was like floored. I was like, wow. I'm like, that's a take. But I forget. Oh, I gotta go back and find. I'll probably find it once we run through all the
I think it was something with how Colin Kaepernick. I think Troy Aikman said something along the lines like how Kaepernick is one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL.
I think it was something like that.
It was really bizarre because it came at the point like right before, like right like where he almost threw a pick or something. It was super bizarre.
And it's like you can't say he's one of the best quarterbacks in the league when all he was doing in that game was running. He didn't throw the ball pretty much at all, and if he did, it was awful. So
the announcer jinx for the win.
Like, I don't know if I think it was something along the lines of that though. And I was like, I heard, I was like, huh? I was like, even back then, I thought he was crap. Like, and that was me as a young kid and an early teenager.
It's weird seeing Troy Aikman have a luscious head of hair. Like, they came back. This is gonna sound really weird, but they came back from halftime, and I'm like, Aikman looks younger. I mean, he obviously does, but it was so weird. I was like, why? Something about it felt weird.
Meanwhile, Bucks looked the same for 30 years.
Did you guys check the quality of this game on YouTube?
Yeah, what I did.
About it was only at 720p.
Yeah. Yeah, if you go back and watch it on YouTube, yeah, it's actually not great.
I did not know.
The quality is actually really bad, even from 2013 standards.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like a game that was played in the late 2000s.
It looks so bizarre. You know, it looks so weird to me. And then I got to ask you this, Shane and Will. Is that the greatest moment, or where does the sorry receiver like Crabtree moment rank? The tip and the post game press conference, both of them together. How does it rank number one in Seattle sports history? It's number one.
It's still, I mean, to this day, it's still. There's never been a moment in my life where I was as hyped for my team as I was right there. You know,
yeah,
and just because it was like, I mean, yeah, the Seahawks, they'd gone to the Super Bowl, you know, 8 years before, but I didn't really remember that. So, because I was five, I also didn't watch football then, but yeah, so I mean, this was just like, you know. It was that moment where it was reality to me. Now it's like, oh, this team is going to the Super Bowl. Like, that is insane. You know, and I mean, what an awesome play to do it too. You know what I mean? So, I mean, to me, it's number one, and it, you know, another good one was Russell Wilson's overtime touchdown pass to Jermaine Kearse that in the NFC Championship game versus the Packers.
That was awesome.
That was great too.
That onside kick was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. It was crazy. I was on cloud.
Actually, no. The part I was most excited about was Marshawn Lynch's touchdown that took the lead at the end of regulation. But I wasn't quite as excited for that because they had just won the Super Bowl the year before. So, you know, for that, I was like, oh, that's cool. But I wasn't like, you know. For me, it's the number one.
When you go for like, you know, when your team goes for the second one, like, you know, it just hits different. Like, it's the first one is the one you'll always remember your entire life. The second one is like, you know, okay, my team is legit, blah, blah, blah. I don't feel as hype. And then after that, you just kind of get, you kind of like, what is it? Like, you know, they say like certain teams get tired of so much success. Like the Patriots get, you know, the end, just get tired of so much success, kind of, and the team doesn't feel the same or look the same, whatever it is. It's like, you know, that second one, like the second time that you even just make it there, like it, and especially when it's back-to-back seasons, pretty much, it's like, you know, you just had that feeling like not even like less than a year ago. So it's like, when you get back there so quickly, it's kind of just like, yeah, you're of course ecstatic, you're happy, but there is a little bit less of a, you know, of a high to it. Like I mean for me it didn't feel that way, because, you know, for me it's like it was the storyline with the Eagles and Chiefs, that's what kept, I wanted revenge, I wanted blood, so
I wanted, you know, blood. So give me blood.
It's different, but like, you know, but like for you guys, it's like, yeah, especially, you know, you got to realize too, I mean, in those years, you know, Seattle obviously doing battle with a prime Aaron Rodgers is one of the scariest things, like one of the best matchups in modern history that we've ever gotten. And it's, you know, every time every time Russell, you know, prime Russell Wilson and prime Aaron Rodgers lock horns, it's like, that was, those games were special.
It was weird hour. Every time they played, something weird happened.
Yeah.
The Fail Mary. Yeah. NFC title game. I was going to say,
remember their first matchup?
Jesus. That.
I still don't agree with that call. Even though, you know, it went in my favor.
You know what I love about that? I would make an argument, and we'll watch that game at some point here down the line in the next few years. The Fail Mary game, I think, single-handedly changed refereeing forever.
Oh, yeah.
I think we'll talk about it more when we eventually get to that game, but I think it did in many different
ways. That was the replacement refs, wasn't it?
It was. It was. You know what's funny? Yeah. That replacement ref wrote a Amazon bestseller, and I have the book somewhere. It's a very good book about what happened afterwards. Like, that decision literally ruined his life for a bunch of years.
Yeah, I could see that.
It was crazy.
Did he happen to live in Green Bay, Wisconsin?
Somewhere around there, I think, like Midwest, or not Midwest, where around there. But I think, I don't fully remember. I know I have the book somewhere. I gotta find it when we eventually get to that game in the future. But for you, Will, where does, you know, the moment of the tip and then the post game, where were you in that moment? Obviously not, you know, being a Seahawks fan, not in the Seattle area, but just that moment for you, I imagine, was also special, even, you know, outside the area.
Yeah, it was a great moment. The biggest thing is that it sucks that I didn't fully pay attention to the game. I think I paid attention mostly to the following year, the Packers game. But this one, I think I remember. Yeah, I remember the Richard Sherman stuff, and then I think I remember like Michael Ben. I believe he was riding the bike, I believe. And yeah, and
the bike. Oh yeah,
yeah. And then it was pretty fun, and I was hyped because I think around that time, I think, well, it was a year ago, I think I was a bit more of, LaDainian Tomlinson, I know he left the Chargers, and then I think I was a little Chargers fan for a little bit during the Phillip Rivers era until I started to leave because I think I'm starting getting more into football. And then I came across the Seahawks. I'm like, okay, this is a team that I want to be a fan of for years to come, and I'm still a fan for two decades later. So that's pretty cool. So I think during that point, it was pretty epic, and it's really like pretty funny that basically what happened that first game, that first play, was kind of an omen to that Super Bowl, having the first play of that Super Bowl the same year. So that was pretty funny. I think they said like something fumbled on the first play, and then someone in the comment section with Peyton Manning is like, hold my beer. So that was pretty funny. I thought during that point that was a pretty good, as far as Seahawks fan, I basically, it was something that was a pretty good moment. And I remember that Crabtree thing about the line, and that was pretty epic as well. And honestly, it was, I saw the penalty. I was like, okay, I thought maybe that going for the handshake, I thought that was a penalty. But I think the penalty was when the Richard Sherman was going for the choking signal. And I guess that was a penalty. Which it's still funny he gave the Gabe Kaepernick the choking thing. But yeah, that was pretty good. And honestly, as a Seattle fan from that time from the Seattle area, I thought that was pretty epic. I think shows a couple of years later, I did went to the Seattle area before they changed it to Lumen Stadium. So yeah, I think it was CenturyLink. So that was a pretty cool. But yeah, it was something that really started I think before the season until now. I think that was some of the start of the upstart of when I became truly a Seahawk fan. So that was a pretty good moment, reliving that moment.
Yeah. All right. Let's do Spider-Man Homecoming. Shane, I'm gonna do something really weird that we haven't done in the history of us doing movies. We're gonna start by time out the end of the movie. Because every time you and I get into a conversation about Tom Holland Spider-Man and we talk about this movie, every time we talk about the dad talk scene, every single time, because it's such an incredible scene. So let's start there, because Keaton and Holland were amazing in that scene.
And not even just the dad talk specifically, but the whole sequence from Peter opens the door at the house and Toomes answers all the way up until Peter gets out of the car. It's, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes probably. But man, I just, that scene is a great example of showing, of characters showing us what they're thinking as opposed to saying it. Because that whole time, you never, if you didn't know, you would not think that Toomes was acting strange at all. He was just, you know, if you were some random person there, you would think they were just having a normal conversation.
I mean, basically Liz. If you were Liz in that conversation,
yeah, that's
pretty
true.
Normal.
Hello. Yeah, I forgot she was there. Anyways, sorry.
She's not that important to the structure of the 7 minutes.
But she is. Because it's what causes him to have some restraint. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He, and so I think, you know, the fact that Michael Keaton was able to show that he was kind of keeping it cool a little bit until she was gone, and the fact that you could see him slowly figure it out as they were driving, and you could just see it on his face, I was like, whoa. I was like, that's cool. Yeah, this is not a twist that I saw coming in this movie. And most of the time, I can see plot twists from a mile away. But this one, or I can't, but then it happens and it's just like so out of left field that it makes no sense. It's like, that's stupid. But this is one of the few that was right in the middle. I was like, oh, that's good. I mean, another one I can think of is in The Incredibles. You know, turns out, what's his name? Buddy is the, yeah. I didn't see that coming either. Then again, I was pretty young when I saw that movie, so I wasn't very smart.
By the way, we're gonna do an Incredibles watch along in July. I'm really excited to watch that again.
I mean, there's that the Civil War twist at the end of the, you know, the goal being to show him the video and not to get the super soldiers, that was really clever. That still blows my mind. But yeah, there's not a lot, but this is one of them. And yeah, I mean, this movie as a whole, you know, I don't think it's quite as grounded as, you know, like the other two Spider-Man origin movies. But I do think it's probably the most fun of the three, at least in my opinion. Just because it really, you know, it really does feel like a coming of age, you know, high school comedy drama, which the other two really don't, because they look way too old. And, you know, neither Andrew or Toby are particularly funny as the character. I mean, Andrew is as Spider-Man, but as Peter, he's not super funny.
Wait, can I pause you there? My favorite line in the entire movie is when Peter's fighting the Avengers in the bank. He just goes, "Let's wrap it up. It's a school night," and he fucking hits him.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, good
stuff like that. Yeah, and so that was yeah, anyways. That's just, you know, that's kind of how I feel about the three Spider-Men in general. It's like, and this, well, I'll get more into this in No Way Home when we see all three of them side by side, but you know, Tom Holland to me is the most fun and entertaining, just because he's, you know, he's young, he's energetic, he's all doughy-eyed and excited to get out there. You know, it's just it's grabbing. I think Andrew's the most comic accurate of the three, and then Toby to me is the most iconic, because, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he is. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. He's, you know, he was the pioneer. He not only for Spider-Man, but for superhero origin movies in general. And
yeah,
you know, so yeah. And, you know, I think the only thing to me that, you know, weighs this movie down a little bit, and it doesn't make it so that I'm like, this movie sucks, you know. It's just, I think it definitely has the MCU's fingerprints all over it, where, you know, they're always talking about the Avengers, and, you know, Tony's in a few scenes, and, you know, there's just different things like that, and, you know, different ways it connects to this movie and that movie, whatever, and that's all fine, you know, but it's just, for a character like Spider-Man, you know, he's supposed to be the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, not the friendly outer space global Spider-Man. I mean, if you know, like, look, if he's going to space and doing all that crazy stuff in Infinity War, sure, it's an Avengers movie with Spider-Man. Yeah, he should be doing crazy stuff like that, you know, if the story calls for it, obviously. But in a movie called Spider-Man, that's just about him, I don't, you know, I don't want this, like, whole high-tech
Chitauri. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chitauri alien stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, and like, you know, the Avengers being mentioned every single scene, and I just want a simple New York, Queens story just about him and his life.
Maybe we'll get that in Spider-Man 4. Maybe.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I'm not hopeful, but let's put it that way. But
yeah,
anyways.
No, because this is after Doomsday. So, oh, by the way, I gotta mention, you know, we did the X-Men last summer, I am so thankful we did the X-Men. Now that once we saw the cast announcement, I was like, oh, thank God we're on the right track here. Because I was getting a little worried because I wanted to do, like, this is kind of a big lead up to Doomsday, because next year we'll do the Captain America movies and the Avengers movies, the Infinity War and Endgame. And I was like, oh, thank God we actually are hitting the right notes here. But no, finish up, Shane.
Yeah, I think,
how do you rate it, also, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I also really, I really enjoy Ned.
Oh, I mean, my God. Yes.
He doesn't, you know, he doesn't have the same, like, you know, interesting character arc that Harry has in the first two movies. Because once Spider-Man 3 came around, I was like, oh boy. But, you know, so he doesn't really have that going for him. But I feel like their friendship is just feels very real. And, you know, like with Toby and James Franco, I never really got the vibe that they were like bros, you know, they just were like two awkward guys cast together, and it was just like, okay. I don't know, maybe that's just me, but and also I really like this portrayal of Aunt May. I know it's not particularly accurate, but you know, when you think about it, I mean, why is a high school kid's aunt like in her 70s or 80s?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. That would be your grandmother, probably.
Hey, Aunt May. How are you? Hope you're wearing something skimpy. I hope. Iron Man quote. So good.
Yeah. I think what's really funny about Robert Downey Jr. hitting on her is that he and Marissa Tomei dated in the 90s.
Yeah.
it's just kind of ironic, but anyways,
that's why they did it too.
That they probably did it, yeah, they did, yeah. That as, yeah.
But anyways, but yeah. So, So the only, you know, the only downsides for me is just, you know, the kind of the like the global, or not even global, but just like the larger world feeling it has. Because like Far From Home, you know, they go to Europe or whatever, but I love that movie because it's, you know, it's just, it's, it feels much more like it's about Peter.
Peter's.
If, no, not Far From Home.
Oh, that's, yeah. Well, we're going to get there.
Yeah, they needed to switch up the names. I get them confused.
I get them confused way too much.
Homecoming, Far From Home, No Way Home.
Like, yeah, please, Jesus please. Christ.
If they put Home in the title for Spider-Man 4, I think I will riot.
They probably will.
No. Please, no.
I'm coming home.
Yeah, Spider-Man 4, going home.
Spider-Man, homeless. but yeah, it's that, and so yeah, that aspect of it, that's like the biggest thing for me. And just how his suit is like so high tech, it's a little strange, but overall, I give this an A-. I really enjoyed it first time I watched it, and I still like it every time, so yeah.
What's your rating? 8? What did you say? 8.5?
A-.
A-. Okay.
Yes.
I think that's fair. Okay. Brandon, we talked about this earlier today. I figured I'd bring it up here. We love the fact that the high schoolers actually look like high schoolers. So yeah. Good.
And that's one thing that I was kind of looking back on, like why all three Spider-Men have, you know, like people love them for different reasons. It's like, oh yeah, because Andrew's is the most comically accurate, and Toby's is probably the most, I guess, well-rounded group of actors. And then you get to, You know, and also just because it's the original, so it's always going to have a place in people's hearts too anyway. And then you get the Toby's. Toby's is probably, Tom's. And you get to his, and it's just like, wow, everybody actually looks like they're supposed to. Like, right. You know, Marissa Tomei actually looks like she could be Aunt May. Like, you know, Tom, when this movie came, when they filmed this movie, Tom was 20 years old. Zendaya was 20 years old. So basically, you know, college kids, but also only 2 years removed from high school, so it's believable. Like, it makes sense. Funny enough, why am I blanking on her name? Laura Harrier, the one that plays Liz in Homecoming. She actually was the oldest of all of them. She was 26 when this movie, or something like that, when this movie was done. Yeah, I think 26. So, but it's funny because she doesn't look 26. Yeah.
Well, and they're also not like, you know, like in the other two, they're all just like insanely muscular and just have insane bodies or whatever, you know. But like in this, they actually just, you know, look like kids, which are not. I mean,
yeah,
you know. I coach baseball and football. 90% of high school students don't have bodies of, you know, Abercrombie and Fitch models or Victoria's Secret models. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, most of them are either a little chubby and overweight or they're pretty skinny. Like, that's...
Oh, no, it's...
You know what I mean?
It's like, you know, when it comes to Toby's, it's the nostalgia and it's the support, the good work of the supporting cast and kind of how dark it kind of is. And then you get to Andrews. Andrews is the most comically accurate. I mean, still a little dark, but most comically accurate. But, you know, but Toby's a little more funnier than Andrews. And then you get to Tom's. Tom's is the, I think, best in terms of the aesthetic. So in terms of the look and the believability of it, I think that's where Tom's is important. So it's like, to me, it's like, you know, each of them has something special, but this movie, to me, I saw it in the theaters when it came out. I saw it with my dad's friend, his stepson. I saw it with him because he's only two years older than me, so he was 19 when it came out. I was 17, and we were watching it because, you know, we both grew up big Spider-Man fans. But we were like, okay, well, you know, we're hyped for it. It's a new Spider-Man series. We didn't really get to see, you know, Andrews too much. I mean, I saw the first one, but I saw that in theaters, but the second one I didn't. So I hadn't seen, and, you know, and obviously we were too young for the original trilogy to see it in theaters, despite growing up on that one. And so this was the first one I could really appreciate seeing in theaters, and I mean, I loved every second of it. I like it. Like, if I had to rank the movies in order, I think, believe it or not, I think No Way Home is the best. I think this is the second best, and I think Far From Home is the least of the three. And I, you know, when I go back to this movie, though, I'm just like, you know, the other two kind of, to me, in this series, in terms of the main characters, not the ones that, not the supporting ones or ones that might come in through later throughout the movie or whatever it is, but just the main core. It feels like there's no real character arc for any of them in these movies. So by the like halfway through the second one, I'm already bored of their characters. I get kind of bored. Like, there's a character arc in the original trilogy. There's somewhat of a character arc in the two for Andrew. I don't see Tom's having much of a character arc, if any. So it does really kind of get boring to me by almost the end of the second one. And then to me, the third gets saved by the fact that obviously we get the Spider-Men in it. But I just, when I look at this one, between the early charm, you know, because this is obviously the early days of you know, the power couple of Tom Holland and Zendaya. And this is obviously kind of where they really hit it off. And obviously they made a name for themselves and things like that. So you know, this movie is important in terms of just what we know of them now, and also just the fact that there was just cool little Easter eggs that referenced the two previous Spider-Man, so you always knew that it was going to set up to be what, you know, Far From Home, you know, oh no, and what No Way Home, all the, what both of those were.
The Benzino was not fresh.
Like, it's like, you know, so I can't hate it. You know, I don't hate this movie at all. I look at Tom's Spider-Man as a whole, and I'm like, he's probably my least favorite of the three. It's just hard because, you know, we only got two with Andrew and the second one, and TASM 2 sucked so bad that it's just like, it's a shame because I think if you just take what TASM 1 was at face value, Andrew's a fantastic Spider-Man. But put it this way, if I had to, you know, when I look at all the movies, but when I look at Tom's, because obviously this is the movie where Tom's, obviously his Spider-Man starts, well, if you don't count his previous appearance in the Avengers movie, but in terms of his own trilogy, when you look at this, you know, he's probably the most aesthetically, like, accurate Spider-Man. He's definitely, I think he's probably the funniest, kind of like boyish charm, obviously, but that goes back to the look. But the boyish charm, kind of funniest of all of them. But he's good at being. He's better at being Peter than he is at being Spider-Man. Andrew's better at being Spider-Man than Peter. Toby was good at both, but funny as a Spider-Man and kind of goofy as a Peter, or nerd and more nerdy. So there's definitely, you know, levels to it. But I think just every interaction that takes place in this movie, I mean, it helps kind of build the movie out more. And obviously we get towards the whole dad talk scene, and that's obviously great. But Mike, to me, it's like, I feel like, and it's the case kind of in all of Tom's, you know, because anything that Tom's done outside of this franchise, people said he's not really that great of an actor. He kind of gets carried in his movies, and I'm like, when I first came out in theaters, I didn't know who he was. I knew nothing about him. I just knew, okay, this is the guy that I just saw. I saw the end of you know, his little cameo appearance with the Avengers, and then okay, we know that he's the next Spider-Man, you know. But I was like, okay, I want to see how this comes out. And then Homecoming was great, but now that I've kind of seen it a bunch of times, and now that I've looked back at it in retrospect, the supporting characters all just carry Tom Holland in all three movies. And I'm not saying that he's bad at doing his part as Spider-Man, but he just feels like he gets carried. Like the bigger name actors that he goes up against or that he's positioned with are just carrying it for him. Michael Keaton carries it. You know, the second one, Gyllenhaal carries it. Third one, you know, Andrew and Toby, they end up stealing the show. So
I will say that I think Tom Holland knows this, and I think this is why he took the role in The Odyssey with Nolan. Because I think Nolan is going to bring a lot more out of him. So I think he also notices this as well.
Yeah. And it's like, but I mean, how much can you really bring out of him when it's been three movies of this and it's still not getting anywhere? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, you know, I know we're not looking at all three of them yet, but, you know, when just looking at this one's great. I love this one. It's just that I think, you know, far no way home is, I keep saying Far From Home. Jesus Christ, man.
We're going to mess it up. It's fine. It's okay.
I just think No Way Home is the best of them, just because it kind of brings everything full circle. It has a lot of just, you know, sad but sweet, funny, you know, cool, you know, people in awe kind of moments. So that's why I love it. It's got so much in it that I like. But this one was a good start to the new trilogy. It's just that, or just the new series, because obviously where they go from here, it's anybody's guess. But like, just this movie by itself is great to me, and it's like, if I just think about this by itself, but I think in the same way that TASM 2 drags down TASM 1 a lot, like, Tom Holland doesn't help himself in Far From Home and No Way Home in terms of his character and the kind of actor he is. So it's like, if I was to just take this movie by itself, I love it. But then when I realize what it is in the context of the rest of the trilogy, I'm like, it's kind of, at least for his part, it just starts just becoming a straight line. There's no upward or downward. It's just straight. Like, there's nothing interesting to me. Yeah. So it's like,
I think it's fair criticism. Yeah. I think it's fair criticism because I think Tom Holland himself also acknowledges some of that as well. With some of his
you do have to make up, you know, when you have shortcomings as an actor, you kind of do have to make up for it in other ways, whether that's getting, you know, other cameos in there, guest appearances, having less speaking lines and things like that, and more kind of action scenes, whatever it may be. Because certain guys are better at it than others, and certain actors can do both. But it's just, you know, when I think about this movie, I'm not thinking about him. I'm thinking about Michael Keaton when I think about this. So it's, you know, it's good for what it is. And the thing is, I love the little Easter egg comments they make to previous movies. And obviously the whole thing of obviously positioning, what the hell was that word I even tried to say? Positioning Zendaya as the next, even though her name is not Mary Jane, it's MJ. So, but having her, you know, kind of reveal that at the end, even though we kind of knew that as the movie went on, but it's just like there's little cutesy things and little kind of cool Easter egg kind of things about that I like. The fight scenes are still really good because this is pre Which Avengers movie is it? Like, what the hell is it? Endgame? This is pre-Endgame.
This is pre-Infinity War and Endgame. Yeah, this is right before it.
This is still when the MCU, you know, was really good, which helps. So the fight scenes are still good. The comedy is still good. The acting is still decent. So, you know, it's not downhill for the MCU at this point. At the same time, so, you know, when you think about all that kind of stuff and the supporting cast and how well they do, and, you know, the first time that all these guys are kind of together, you know, this core group of actors for this trilogy, it's a really, really good movie. It's really well done. It's just that it's, you know, it's hard for me to take the not sour taste, it doesn't go downhill from here, but just the bland taste I get from it when I think about it in the context of the other three. So if I had to rate it, I would probably say, I mean, it's my second favorite in the series, so I can't rate it above No Way Home. But I think if I had to rate it, it's probably an 8.5 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, that's exactly where I have it, 8.5. Will, what are your thoughts on this movie?
Because I remember when this first happened, when I first saw it, I kind of was disinterested because
nope. Robotic.
Will, you're being robotic. Oh no. Back out and back in if you need to.
It's funny when it happens.
It is actually pretty good.
Hear me now?
Yes. Yeah, you're good. You're good. You're totally good. Go for it.
Yeah, actually, at first, when I saw this, and I saw that they have Tom Holland not as Spider-Man, I was sort of indifferent about it. Honestly, I still am. Like, Tom Holland as Peter's pretty good as Spider-Man. He has lots of love to be desired for him. I guess he got, like, the pureness of Spider-Man down at most points. But I don't know. I just don't really see him as, like, a Spider-Man that I can really get into. Now, with the movie, I think the movie is a mixed bag for me. I think the main villain, Vulture, I think he's all right. I think the look of him is pretty well done. because they call him like a demon in the sky. So that was pretty good. I like the ties to how he said like where he got like where Tony Stark gets the all the gadgets and equipment stuff like that. And I guess that ties into basically with Tom Holland like idolizing or Peter Parker idolizing Tony Stark in that way. And honestly, I think it's a movie that obviously, like, I agree, it's still around the time when MCU was still hot. And I think that it was a pretty good, like, you know, follow-up to Infinity War, this appearance of Civil War, I mean. And it was a pretty good follow-up.
There's just too many damn movies. I'm sorry, Will, but there's too many movies.
I know. I was saying Infinity War, Civil War. Okay. Yeah, it was Civil War. And it was a good follow-up to that because that was first Spider-Man appearance. When I saw that, I was like, okay, well, honestly, the design is pretty, like, and I said it before, like, I feel like it's too much of a, like, of selling toys. But I think it's a good, like, you know, kid-friendly type design instead of, like, you know, the Andrew Garfield and the Tobey Maguire's more rough edge, more like grungy or more like serious costumes till they messed it up with the TASM 2 one, which I never forget them for that one. But with this one, I thought it was a decent movie. I thought May was a bit younger than I was expecting for Aunt May because I always associate Aunt May as more of an old lady. I thought that the best friendship between him and between those two, between his friend, Peter's friend, I thought those two had a pretty good, like, genuine friend vibe to them. Though I felt like most of the thing is a bit cringe with the jokes they try to pull most of the time. But yeah, I think it really peaked for me was the dad talk. And honestly, when I first saw it, I was like, I still forgot that he was actually the girl that he liked dad before Mary Jane. I thought that was a pretty good revelation because I was, as a viewer, I was like, oh, snap, because I didn't see that coming. I think Tom Holland Peter thought he was the vulture. He was that guy that he was trying to chase after. And that's why he was a bit cautious. And especially when he told him about what he's going to do with his daughter and stuff like that, I kind of felt that too. So that was pretty good. It kind of sucks that he stood up for her in the dance, but I guess he was trying to don't want to do that to her mostly. And it sucks that he wasn't really upfront with her, but I guess he wasn't there with her as far as relationship goes. It's like in between those two characters. And I thought that was, it kind of sucks that she had to move out and stuff like that. But then I knew they was, when they moved out, they go put Mary Jane. And when I saw Mary Jane, I was like, I don't know. This Mary Jane doesn't feel for me, guys, because I can't go, because she feels too goth to me. Like, a goth Mary Jane just, I don't know, just feels like pretty, pretty mid. But, and also now we know in real life, now they're a power couple. Now we're going to see them again in the future. And I'm like,
are we? Are we, though?
I think we are. They're gonna find a way. But I think last time, I guess you guys watched the No Way Home movie. But
yeah,
I
know at the end we're gonna watch it. We're gonna watch it next week again. This is gonna be great. Again,
but can I say what happened? Or you want to?
Oh no, you can say it. You can say it. Everyone knows.
Because I know at the end, you know, everyone's minds are raced because Peter Parker wanted to. He wanted to do something selfless at least, but then it wound up screwing everyone, and then Doctor Strange had to fix everyone up, and now they forgot who he is now, and I guess I'm not sure what's the next direction for that. It probably some more multiverse stuff again, but who knows? But honestly, I don't know. It's be up to what the viewers want. Honestly, I think it's gonna happen at least. But who knows for that one. But yeah, honestly, Mary Jane, honestly, I feel indifferent about her. Just feel like the direction of her is a bit, I don't know, a bit left to be desired for me. But it shows that she's more of a smarter one. She's like a little bit of well, she's grungy, but shows that she can actually do stuff on her own a bit, just like the Insomniac Mary Jane, but less annoying than the other one. But she's like grungy a bit that I'm like, I'm indifferent, but I'll try to like growing on me a little bit. But I guess the real life stuff really annoys me a bit between her and Tom Holland. But I thought the movie overall was pretty solid. I said it was a mixed bag at first, but now I feel like it's pretty solid. But I'll probably give it 7.5. I think it's a grade that I think acceptable, and I think really a vulture. I think Michael Keaton, like the way he was able to do that as a villain, this in contrast to what he was as like Batman, is like night and day. So that was like pretty good versatile type of stuff, be like the hero Batman when he's younger years, and then and older he's more of the like the older, bitter type of old man that basically create all the suit of stuff to basically make a quick rich scheme and sell these dangerous weapons from the tech during the first like Avengers sort of a deal with when he was battling Loki, I believe. But yeah, I thought the movie was pretty okay. It has the ups and downs for me, but yeah, I'll give it 7.5.
Yeah,
I'm thinking about too that we've kind of forgot to mention is that, and what I wish they would have done more with, instead of just, you know, having it kind of just go into end up in Across the Spider-Verse, was they had Donald Glover play pretty much Aaron Davis, which is the Prowler.
Yeah, we'll see more of him, I think, when Miles officially comes into the MCU.
There's one thing. I didn't like how they did with the Shocker. I think they...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't like, great. You be the Shocker. Basically just give him the gun. Like, oh, come on, man. Like, the Shocker's one of the most iconic... not really iconic than
he's a fun character. He's a fun character.
Like Ock or a Venom or something like that. Yeah, he's a fun character because I remember when Spectacular Spider-Man, that cartoon when it came out, he was pretty solid, and I just feel like, man, it's like you just basically butchered that character. Though I feel like Kevin Feige didn't give a shit, but I just feel like, man, the way they did the shock character was like, man, you just be the you can be like anyone can be the Shocker. I'm like, well, that's not a slap in the face to Stan Lee.
Yeah, I didn't like that much either. My biggest problem with the movie is Sony in a lot of different ways, because I think some of it, like the Iron Man suit, they didn't have enough budget to like enhance the Iron Man suit, so it's pretty basic. There's just like some silver in there. But other than that, it's a fun movie. I feel like I've watched this movie 100 times. I know every scene. I just enjoy it, and that's pretty much it. I just think it's a lot of fun, and that's why it gets an 8.5 for me. Is that it's just like, I feel like that's what Spider-Man movies should be. They should be fun. Should be some emotion, but you know, they should be really fun. I think this hits, you know, all those right notes. Guys, guess what we're gonna talk about next here? I'm gonna hear the biggest groan ever. We're gonna talk about Morbius. Yay! No, we're gonna talk about Morbius.
No.
Because Michael Keaton as the Vulture, Adrian Toomes, he gets transported to this defunct now defunct Sony Spider-Man universe. So he gets somehow put into a cell in the SSU, and then he randomly meets Morbius, and he says, "I don't know how I got here. Something to do with Spider-Man. I'm thinking of putting a team together, do some good." And Morbius just says, "Intriguing." And that's the whole post-credit scene. This is the whole damn thing. What?
Now I gotta go for that. PTSD, how bad that movie is with Jay Leto.
Oh, it's so bad. It's awful. I guess it's still canon that he's in that universe. I don't know. It's weird. It's dumb. It's the worst post-credit scene in the history of post-credit scenes. You know what made that funnier? Michael Keaton had a interview. I think it was with comicbookmovie.com or something. And they asked him about it, and he said Sony, he basically said that the Sony execs explained it to him, or somebody explained it to him, the whole scene, and he was like so confused the entire time filming it, which I think is the most amazing thing ever.
I wonder why.
Which is just awesome in so many different ways. But yeah, so Sony's messing with the characters again in a lot of different ways. But yeah, I figured we'd bring up Morbius. The scene is so funny. Because it's probably the funniest part of the movie, because I remember when I watched Morbius, and I rented it from the library and I watched it. I actually flipped my lid with that post-credit scene. I literally flipped my lid like everyone else. And I still am all these years later. But yeah, it's an 8.5 for Spider-Man Homecoming. It's a 0 for Morbius. That movie's terrible. It's more like a 5. It's more like a 5 or a 6. Yeah, don't watch it. It's terrible. It's more like a 5 or a 6. Don't even touch it. It's awful. But that being said, no, this gets an 8.5 for Homecoming. We'll watch No Way Home as a group, our first watch along next week. That's gonna be a fun one. I think probably Friday night we'll do that. I'm not sure yet, but we'll figure it out as we go. But yeah, that is it for today. For Will, for Shane, for Brandon, for myself. We will see you next week. We got a fun one. We're gonna do NFL team Mount Rushmore players, courtesy of Will. Just do players, and do talk about some of the greatest players to ever play this game for all 32 NFL clubs next week. That's going to be super fun. But we'll see you then. Have a great rest of your week, everybody.
See ya.
See ya.
Sounds good. Take care, everybody.